Good evening. Thank you for joining us on this Wednesday night. This is Sports Takeover on RMU Radio. Matt and Chris, as always, let's get started. First, we have a couple things to report on the retirement front. Chris, why don't you lead us off there?
All right, so the first come from MMA / boxing / UFC / whatever fighting you want to consider. It's Conor McGregor. He announced he is stepping down from, I believe he said, the sport formerly known as mixed martial arts was... Am I right on that quote, Matt?
I believe so.
Yeah, it was odd, but he's an odd guy who certainly has had his run of troubles. He's a very good fighter, though, so the sport will definitely miss him. I wouldn't be so surprised if he came back, though. He's definitely a guy that is indecisive, but as it stands right now, he has retired.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think that he might not actually be done. He is only 30 years old, and you said a very good fighter, 21-4 in his career, 18 wins by TKO or KO, so very impressive career, if it is the end of a career.
Only 25 fights? That seems low, too.
They don't fight very often. I'm not into that as much as some people are, but I don't think that they fight very often. Only here and there, but
interesting.
A very good record for him there. Another guy who's had a lot of success, the biggest of the retirements that we have to mention, is Rob Gronkowski. 29 years old, 9 seasons with the New England Patriots, 3 Super Bowl titles to his name, and a very impressive career, 521 receptions for 7,861 yards and 79 touchdowns. A lot of injuries over his career. I think this is a good move for him. 3 championships, the money he's made. I think he can get into whatever he wants to as well. So fantastic career and one of the best tight ends of all time.
Yeah, Gronk certainly has a personality away from his on-the-field just player himself. He's a very excellent tight end. I would say the most dominant of his time. I don't know that he's necessarily the best tight end ever, but
if you put him
on the field, I would say Tony Gonzalez, but if you put him on the field, there are a handful of guys that could stop him effectively over multiple interaction with them. He has more than doubled the next closest Patriots receiver for touchdown receptions from Tom Brady, so clearly he's been his favorite target. Hopefully the Patriots will miss him. Hopefully it'll deter them this season. I've crossed our fingers in this one, but certainly an illustrious career from him. 2 more receivers announced their retirement, a little bit more minor. First comes Jeremy Maclin. I haven't really followed him the last few years. I know he was doing well with Philadelphia a few years ago, but I don't know where he was most recently. Can you fill me in on that one?
Yeah, so he spent a couple of seasons in Kansas City, 1 in Baltimore, and then sat out 2018. 30 years old for Jeremy Maclin, 9 seasons, 514 receptions, almost 7,000 yards and 49 touchdowns, former first-round pick. Like you said, Philadelphia was very good to him. He was solid in Kansas City, not as good in Baltimore, and then, of course, set out last season. So another young player there retiring, but a solid career for Jeremy Maclin. And then Jordy Nelson, 33 years old, so the oldest of our retirees.
Not that 33 is old, though.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. But for football, you're getting up there. 10 seasons for him, Super Bowl champion with the Green Bay Packers. He has 613 receptions in his career, 8,587 yards, and 72 touchdowns. Not as effective in his one season in Oakland last year. Hard for anyone to be effective in the situation that he found himself in. But in Green Bay, certainly a solid player. And as I said, a Super Bowl champion. So a very nice career for him.
Yeah, he was definitely Aaron Rodgers' favorite target once Greg Jennings departed from the team. He was the favorite for a good reason. He was an excellent receiver. Showed his excellence in the Super Bowl victory over the Steelers, as you mentioned. When he went to Oakland, it was kind of already the end of his career. It makes sense for him to retire now. He reminds me a lot of Eric Decker in a sense. They're both receivers that were very good with one quarterback, tried to move teams, just didn't work out as well for them. But yeah, definitely a good career for Jordy Nelson and a good career for all of these retirees. Staying in football, though, another quick topic to hit on. It comes in the Alliance of American Football. We've talked about him a few times throughout the course of the spring in their inaugural season. Well, according to the majority owner, Tom Dundon, in an article written by USA Today, apparently the AAF is in jeopardy. It's not for monetary reasons this time. We reported a few weeks back that he had to invest $250 million into this league basically to help keep it afloat, which monetary issues haven't really come up since then. However, the issue now is with the NFL and specifically the NFLPA. Apparently, Dundon believes that the AAF needs more cooperation from the NFLPA to allow its younger players, you know, maybe some guys that are on the practice squad or that get cut from training camp rosters, to help play them in the AAF, because the AAF is a feeder league for the NFL. That's what they're trying to be. They're trying to be the AAA baseball to the Major League Baseball. Dundon thinks that if they don't continue to cooperate, that maybe folding the league is one possible solution. I don't know that that's necessarily the best. I guess it's kind of an extreme, oh, you force my hand situation, but he does say a decision will be made in the coming days.
So I haven't read a whole lot about it. I did see everything that you said. I'm not going to read too far into it. For me, I think there could be a couple things behind it. Number one, I think it could be kind of to force the NFLPA's hand to make them really consider whether or not this is something that they want to be a part of. Because I don't think, you said monetarily, I don't think they're having any issues. Financially, they're good. I think that they've been popular, not obviously to the extent that the NFL is, but that's not what they expected. I think that they've been popular in their own right, and I think that they've had a successful season. Until there's more to this, I'm not going to look that far into it. And you mentioned that he said in a couple of days they would have a decision or something would be resolved. So I'm just going to wait and see for that. I don't think this is necessarily anything to be overly concerned with just yet, because you can still be a developmental league without having players from the NFL come to you. You can be a stepping stone to the NFL and still serve your purpose, even if the NFLPA does not cooperate the way you want them to. So for me, I'll believe it when I see it. I think they're going to be okay.
Yeah, well, what I was reading was that nobody from the NFLPA was cited because it's, you know, kind of a intense measure or whatever. But someone did say that their concern is that with the collective bargaining agreement, that the rest and the mandatory workouts would not work out together. So basically with the CBA that came in effect a few years ago, OTAs, different training camps, different off-season workouts were reduced so that, you know, players can get the proper rest that they deserve in the off-season, so that, you know, players aren't feeling forced to come in and, you know, work out with the team every 3 weeks or however many it might be. I'm not certain on the specifics, but obviously if a guy is in the AAF, it's assumed that, you know, they're going to be practicing week in and week out. And if this is a guy that, you know, maybe is practicing on the practice squad all season in the NFL, you know, wants to try to get his crack at a roster, so he goes to the AAF for all spring. Well, there's 10 more weeks of the off season where he's working out, and then maybe he goes back to the NFL come July. You know, that's a short off season. Another point they brought up was, well, what if somebody gets an injury that might impact them, that they can't play in the NFL that season? That would then affect their financial situation, because obviously the AAF does not create the revenue for players that the NFL will create, whether you're on the practice squad or not. It's still more money to be in the NFL. So that's what the NFLPA's whole issues with the thing is. But yeah, I wouldn't take it anymore as it's a very big threat. Obviously, shutting down the league is huge. I wouldn't imagine it would happen during the middle of the season. I would imagine this whole season will play out. But what comes in the future could rely on the relationship that these two parties are trying to work out with each other, I think.
See, I think my thing when it comes to the CBA and when it comes to, you know, mandatory workouts and reducing that and the injury risk that's posed to these players, to me, I feel like that's the player's decision. You know, if I'm somebody who's on the fringe of making the NFL and I think that going to the AAF I can further myself, that's something that I'm going to take a risk on, I think, as a player. And it would be different to me if teams were sending guys to the AAF saying, you need to go play with, you know, in this league, so that when you come back to us next year, we have a better player. That doesn't, to me, to my understanding, that's not what it is. It would be the player voluntarily going to the AAF, voluntarily signing a contract to play in that league. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, but the problem with that is that, and if everybody in the NFL is in union with it, that's what the NFLPA is. It's a union, so right. It's not as easy to leave a union. It'd be like saying, you know, say you work at a steel mill, you know, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, whatever. Well, what if you're trying to make some side money at another establishment on the weekend? Maybe there's a contractual obligation that says, well, you can't do this if you're going to be with us. I think that's kind of what the issue is that they're saying here. They don't want the contracts to coincide with each other. I mean, the idea for them to work in unison with each other is obviously a very good idea. I think it's one that will work over time. It's just some of these details need to be ironed out that maybe they hadn't considered initially. But as far as I know, I don't think that the independent risk is as important, though.
Yeah, I mean, if they're contractually obligated to not go do that, then that's different. There's no way around that. I just think that if that's what the situation is, that's how you need to present it and say that this is why we can't do it, and not say anything about, you know, the risk of injuries to players, because to me, that's not something that they have control over. That's in the players. That's to the player's discretion. Right. If it's contractual, that's fine. Say it that way.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a very big gray area, but one way or another, the AAF will not be folding this season. What lies in the future, a little bit more murky with these kind of allegations. We'll see how it develops. Not so sure that anything will anytime soon. Major League Baseball, however, a lot more developments in the last week. Last week, we presented our season preview, gave our predictions for division winners, some of the trades, offseason signings that may have happened. Well, in the last 7 days, there have been nothing but money being thrown around to all these players. Mike Trout signed his huge contract last week. In the spring training game, his walk-up song was Money, Money, Money. Well, we saw a lot more players, specifically pitchers, this week receive the money. Matt, would you care to start us off?
Yeah, Chris Sale in Boston got 5 years at $145 million. 30 years old there, just won the World Series with the Red Sox. Top six in Cy Young voting since 2012, each year since 2012, so certainly someone who's deserving of the money.
But never a Cy Young, though, just always top six.
Yeah, actually, we talked about this the other day. If you would have asked me, I would have swore that he had won one, but that's just because he's so close every year. He hasn't. Surely, hopefully, he will eventually. But no, I think that this is a good deal. Yeah, for sure, for him and for Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a 2023, there's a player opt-out. 2025 is a vested option. That means that he needs to meet some sort of requirement. I don't know if it's Cy Young race or ERA, but anyway, there's some requirement he has to meet to make that. Either way, he'll be 37 when he's an unrestricted free agent. Another player that will be 37 when they are unrestricted is Paul Goldschmidt. First baseman was traded to the Cardinals in the offseason. He signed a five-year, $130 million extension. I didn't really look into the opt-out clause for that one, but anyway, getting Paul Goldschmidt for 5 years, excellent. Definitely one of the best first basemen, I think, in the National League. He's better than everyone else. He's finished in MVP voting top five several times. He's definitely a guy that can help the Cardinals. Getting him for 5 years, solid deal there.
Yeah, so of the ones that we're going to list here, it's not my favorite, but it's an honorable mention for me because three-time Gold Glove winner, four-time Silver Slugger, and you talked about the MVP, three times he's finished in the top three in the voting. So it's a guy that's shown results, and for the Cardinals, I think they feel like it's a guy who takes them to the next level, and I think from what we've talked about on the show, we would feel the same way. I think Paul Goldschmidt is what takes them to a playoff team, maybe a contender down the road. So to give him this contract, it's not unreasonable. For a guy who's shown the results, I think it's one of the better contracts, one of the better extensions that we've seen in the last week.
Yeah, definitely. Another guy, a little bit of a smaller deal, but hey, he's still young. It's the former AL Cy Young winner, Blake Snell. He got a five-year, $50 million extension with the Rays. When you look at a guy who won the Cy Young, you're thinking, oh, only $10 million a season? That's not a lot. Well, he's not pitched that much in the major leagues. He's only going to be 31 when he becomes an unrestricted free agent. So seeing how he's only sitting in his mid-20s, I think has 2 or 3 years under his belt right now. These are avoiding the arbitration years, avoiding pre-arbitration years. Obviously, he will make more money after this $50 million runs out, but for the Rays to get him at this price right now, it's great value, especially on a team that doesn't like to pay anybody anything. They have lowest payroll in all of Major League Baseball, so good to get him there.
This one's my favorite. I like this one a lot because he is by far the youngest on this list. I think the youngest by 3 years of all these guys who recently got sizable extensions. For $10 million a year for a guy who just showed he was the best pitcher in the American League, I think that's fantastic. And it is a small sample size, but worst case scenario is he becomes an average pitcher over the course of this deal and you pay him $10 million. Compared to some of the money that we're seeing get thrown around, $10 million is not a big hit for the Rays. Go ahead.
I believe last season Homer Bailey made over $20 million, and I want to say his record was 1-18. I'm going to check that real quick. You can go on to the next guy. But there's a guy, Homer Bailey. He is making way too much money to do nothing. And Blake Snell is, you know, could potentially have top five Cy Young voting.
Yeah, he's making half of that, and he's shown more results recently.
Yeah, last year, Homer Bailey went 1-14 with a 6.09 ERA, and he made over $20 million.
Right. So you see these teams getting themselves into bad contracts that only a few years after they're signed, no longer pay off. I think this is one that it's 5 years, so it locks him up through his arbitration years, as you said. Takes him to the age of 31. I think it's a good length. It's good money. I like this one. This is my favorite of the extensions that we have here in the last week.
Some more extensions, though. Still pitchers. Some older guys. You said that Snell was a great one because he's young. Well, there's still old guys that are doing nothing wrong with what they are pitching on the mound. Justin Verlander, 2 years, $66 million. That's an average value of $33 a year. That's a lot of money. That's three times the amount that Blake Snell's made. Well, he obviously has the track record in his past to prove it. He's done excellent with the Astros, was top five in Cy Young voting with them last season. He will be 39 when that contract expires. It's only 2 years. There's no sorts of player options or anything. Obviously, at that point, he'll reevaluate, you know, his whole career, not just with the Astros. But getting him for 2 years locked up at $33 million, it's a good deal because I feel like he's worth every penny that they're paying him.
This is my other honorable mention because I do like this one a lot. 2 years, regardless of it being $33 million or being $3 million, for 2 years, you're not locking yourself into anything crazy. It's a guy who's won a Cy Young. It's a guy who's won an MVP. And last year, even though he is 36, just last year, he was an all-star, finished second in the Cy Young voting in the National League, and finished 10th in MVP voting.
American League, maybe.
American League, you're right. Fantastic season, though, for him last year. Even though his age, he is getting up there in age, that just goes to show that he can still play. the Astros are in contention right now. Keeping a guy like this is important. I like this contract a lot.
Yeah, another little bit more interesting one. It goes back to the National League. It's in the NL Central. It's with
the National League for real this time.
Yeah, the Chicago Cubs. Kyle Hendricks. He's a guy that's kind of fallen off since he had his National League leading ERA season a few years back, but he signed a four-year, $55.5 million extension with a vested option for 2024. He'll be 35 when he becomes an unrestricted free agent. He's not the guy that's going to pound the strike zone and get you 10, 12 strikeouts like a Verlander, like a Sale might get you. But he's definitely a guy that's going to give you consistency, and that's exactly what the Cubs need, I think. I like him more than most people probably do. I think it's a very good deal for him because strikeouts don't mean everything to pitchers, but Kyle Hendricks is certainly a good guy to lock up for that time.
Personally, this is my least favorite of the extensions, and it's not that I don't like it. It's just that, you know, we're naming off these awards that other guys have accomplished, or the fact that they finished high in the voting for these awards or whatever. And for Kyle Hendricks, he doesn't have any of that. Now, he was third in Cy Young voting in 2016 when he led the league in ERA. So he certainly has proven that he can play. At 29, he's not on the wrong side of 30 yet, as some of these guys are that are getting longer contracts. It will put him, what'd you say, 33?
35.
35 by the time that this is over. So I don't love that for a guy who hasn't shown you exactly what you want to see. But at the same time, it's not an unreasonable contract. So not my favorite, but I don't dislike it.
Now, the last one I'm going to mention, I think, is my personal favorite. It goes to the National League Cy Young winner, Jacob DeGrom. He signed a four-year, $120.5 million extension. He has a player option in 2023, a club option in 2024. Now, I had thought he was a guy that was about 25, 26 years old, all right, going to be entering his prime. Well, I was sadly mistaken because when his contract expires, he will be the ripe young age of 37. So good for the Mets to lock him up now because clearly he's gotten better each year despite being a little bit older than some may have expected. But you know, $120 million is a lot of money, making $30 million a year, a little bit less than some of the other guys, less than Sale, less than Verlander, but I think he's definitely going to deserve all of this.
Yeah, I also did not realize that he's 31 years old, but he is the reigning Cy Young winner in the National League. He did lead Major League Baseball with a sub-2 ERA, 1.7.
Ridiculous.
Is just a mind-boggling number, and he has been very good recently, so you know, by the time it's over, he's 37. Are you paying him too much? Time will tell. But for right now, the Mets need to cling to something, and for them it's Jacob DeGrom, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, since they lost the World Series to the Royals, they've kind of been a team that's lacked an identity. We've seen a new GM come in the offseason. They've made some interesting trades, help, you know, get some veterans on the team that can help get this team where they need to be. When you have Jacob DeGrom, when you have a Noah Syndergaard, you can't waste that kind of talent on your team. Locking him up for four more years, definitely the right move right there.
So one of the articles that I read when I was going through these extensions suggested that maybe all these contract extensions are bad for free agency and will eventually be bad for Major League Baseball. Do you have a thought on that real quick before we move on?
Well, I think the free agents and the agents that employ these are employed by these free agents are already bad for baseball. We saw this offseason, Bryce Harper and Manny Machado took about as long as you possibly could take to sign with the team. I mean, people were playing spring training games before they had decided where they were going to play. It was annoying as a baseball fan. I mean, I guess it's free agency is exciting for some. It certainly is exciting in the NFL, as we talked about last few weeks, so many different deals. MLB, though, I would like to see that players sticking to teams. One of the things I hate about the NBA is that every offseason, it's, all right, this player signed a one-year deal. Where is he going to go next year? You know, where is Kevin Durant going last offseason? Where is he going this offseason? Well, you don't have to worry about that in baseball. You're like, okay, here's a team that knows their player, knows they're good, appreciates them, gets them on their team. And I like the different options that we saw. A lot of player, a lot of club, a lot of vested options. So you're not just going to get the money thrown to you. You kind of have to prove it to the team and yourself still that you deserve it. So I don't think that extensions are bad for free agency.
Okay. I think it depends on how you look at it. I think for the teams it could be because you've got less guys to choose from, obviously. But for the players, I think it can be good because if there's fewer top-notch players on the markets, you become more valuable. If you have five guys that are at the very top of the list, you might not get as much if a team can go after somebody else for cheaper. But if there's only two of you, if teams are really looking to fill a hole, they're going to give you more money, kind of like we saw this offseason when it was Machado and Harper over everybody else. So in that sense, I think it could be good for the free agents. Does that mean it's good for baseball? Not necessarily.
Yeah, well, and also, there's still free agents. Dallas Keuchel is not signed yet. Craig Kimbrell is not signed yet. Check your watches, folks, but there's less than 24 hours till the whole Major League Baseball begins the 2019 season, and these are two premier players that have not signed anywhere yet. I'm sure that Craig Kimbrell was offered a contract extension with the Red Sox at some point last year. Dallas Keuchel turned down a 5-year, $90 million deal with the Astros either last year or the year before. Well, these are guys that no longer have the contract. So, you know, they're betting on themselves, I guess, to go in the free agency, but maybe that they're not receiving the same bets that they thought they'd have. It's not so good for them. So I think the extensions are good for sure.
Okay. Well, that wraps up MLB. Now let's move into the leagues that are getting closer to the end of their regular season as opposed to the beginning. And let's take a look at the playoff push. Let's start in the National Basketball Association. In the Eastern Conference right now, we have five teams clinched. Number one is Milwaukee, two is Toronto, followed by Philadelphia, Indiana, and Boston all have clinched their spots. I think there's a pretty well-defined line between these five and everybody else in the East.
Yeah, absolutely. So Milwaukee currently leads the Eastern Conference and all of the NBA at 56-19. That's good for about 75% win percentage. Phenomenal. Milwaukee's having a great season. They have already clinched the Central Division. So basically, they just got to ride out the rest of the season and keep the same momentum going forward into the playoffs. There's a real disparity, though, between the one and the five. Boston is in the fifth seed, and they are 12 games back of Milwaukee. It's the one to two is four-game difference. Two and three is a 4.5. A little bit closer between the three and the five. There's two separating each of them. But really, most of these five teams have sort of carved out their paths. They've been the teams that have been in these spots all season. It's when we get more towards the bottom of the Eastern Conference that things start to get murky. Between the 6 and the 10 seeds, they are only separated by 2.5 games, so there are certainly tons of wiggle room to be had between them teams.
Yeah, so there's a 6-game cushion between the Celtics and the 6-seeded Detroit Pistons at the moment. After that, though, I mean, you've got a mess. It's the Pistons, followed by the Nets are there at 38-37. The Pistons are 37-37. Magic are 37-38. So obviously there's no separation among those three teams whatsoever. The Miami Heat are right behind, and then the Charlotte Hornets are right there behind them. Anything could happen there. It's 2.5 games, I believe, that separate all those teams.
Yeah, and they're all just such mediocre teams that it's so hard to say who's going to be good and who's not going to be good. I mean, Miami was leading their division. I believe they were 24-20 at some point earlier in the season. They were like in sixth place. Well, clearly they have fallen off of that. And the one thing that really gives me is that, so the NBA does a 1-8 traditionally just based upon teams that have good records. However, each of the three divisions gets represented by at least one team. Orlando is leading the Southeast right now, and they are the 8 seed. So between Orlando, Miami, and Charlotte, and Washington, those are the four teams that are basically vying for that 8 seed. Well, they're all vying for the same division too, so very close between them. The Nets and the Pistons, while close, kind of have, a little bit easier. I don't know, because they don't have to worry about the other competition as much. I don't assume that they will be playing each other as much with only a few games left. But Southeast, it's very, very jumbled right there.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at one game separating 6 through 8, and then only a half a game separating you from 9, one game beyond that to 10. So I wouldn't say that any of those teams are safe. The top five have clinched, obviously. They're in. There's nothing that anyone else is going to do about it. But I think other than that, the bottom three are up for grabs, and there's more than three teams vying for them. So it's going to be certainly an interesting end to the season in the Eastern Conference.
But does anything really matter for these teams? In my opinion, no. I don't think that any of these bottom three teams will pose much more than a small, maybe one or two game victories in playoff series. It really is the five teams that have clinched that are vying for the Eastern Conference. These teams, as far as I'm concerned, have no chance whatsoever. On the Western Conference side, though, pretty much all 8 teams, I think, have a very equal chance. So currently, as it sits, there are 8 games that separate the 1 through the 8, the 1 being Golden State and the 8 being San Antonio. That is a huge difference, considering the 1 through 3 in the East are separated by 8.5 games. So for the fact that all 8 teams are separated by such a small margin makes every game so much more important for playoff positioning. You know, obviously you don't want to play Golden State first round. They, year in and year out, do very well. You probably don't want to play Denver first round. Actually, Golden State is tied right now in first with Denver at 50-23. So definitely some strong competition between those teams. And really, you want to get the home court advantage. Being in that top four is so crucial. Golden State and Denver are pretty much set as the 1 and the 2 in whatever order. Then beyond that, between the 3 and the 8, they are separated by a mere 4 games. So any sort of huge win or loss swing could affect these teams so dramatically.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible how different the East is from the West. In the East, we have our 5, and after that, it's anyone's game for the 6 through 8. But in the West, we essentially have our 8. only the top five have clinched so far, so we're similar to the East in that situation. But, I mean, it's more so the positioning of these eight teams than it is will these eight teams be the eight teams at the end of the season. You talked about how close everything is. Obviously, there's not a lot of games left to be played, but as soon as one team goes on a losing streak or one team goes on a winning streak, this whole thing is totally different. Take the Clippers, for example. They're on a six-game winning streak, and they're 9-1 in their last 10. They've shot the whole way up to fifth place, and they're only two games out of third place. A week ago, this was a team that was in the Spurs position in eighth. So all it takes is 1 week, 2 weeks, that type of a span, and you totally change your playoff position. And I'll talk about this later on in the show. The home court advantage in the NBA is very real compared to the NHL or really anywhere else. I mean, it's always a real thing, but it is unbelievably real in the NBA. The difference between being the 4 and the 5 alone is going to be huge for these teams in the Western Conference.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we said, there's only eight games separating the 1 through 8. There's only one other team that can make the playoffs besides those eights. That's the Sacramento Kings. Everybody else has been eliminated. But the Kings sit 5.5 back of the Spurs, so effectively they're eliminated. I really don't foresee the Spurs and Kings swapping or anybody else really swapping with the Kings. It's pretty much those eight are set. But yeah, the win streaks are huge because right now Oklahoma City sits at 7th. Well, in the pretty much for the whole other part of 2019, they've been 3rd, 4th. They've consistently been at the top of the West. And now all of a sudden they've had, you know, it's a tough string of games. They're 4-6 in their last 10. It's not going to get the job done when literally everybody else in the playoffs is above 500 in their last 10. They are the only team that is struggling. And yeah, you said the home and road differential is huge in the NBA. The Warriors and the Nuggets both have positive records at home and the road, but Portland is the 3 seed. Well, they have a losing record on the road even. San Antonio has 10 more losses on the road than they do at home. I find it hard for them to move out of the 8 and up to the 4 maybe, so it's going to be tough for them. But yeah, huge disparity between home and road in the NBA for sure.
Very interesting outlook on the NBA playoffs. Now let's move to the NHL playoff push, starting in the Eastern Conference and the Metropolitan Division. As it stands coming into tonight, the Washington Capitals are in first place with 98 points in 77 games, followed by the Penguins and the Islanders, who each have 95 points in 77 games. Behind them, vying for a wild card spot and potentially trying to get into that top three, the Carolina Hurricanes, followed by the Columbus Blue Jackets. Your thoughts on the Metro?
Well, the Metro, I see it as it's two different tiers. So Washington, Pittsburgh, and New York are all in the top tier. They are separated by 3 points. The Islanders and Capitals have been at the top all year. The Penguins have moved around between being third, being second, being the wild card, but given their play of recent, I think they've kind of solidified themselves as one of the top three. Can they still win the division? Of course. Is it more likely that they will be the 2 or the 3? Absolutely. I don't really see them slipping back down to the wild card. Carolina sits 4 points behind at 91 points right now, but they do have a game in hand over the Penguins and Islanders. So, you know, one win can put them 2 points behind. And then there's Columbus. They made so many moves at the deadline. We were talking about how, you know, on paper, this is the year that Columbus needs to compete. Well, both you and I agree that with John Tortorella, they will not compete. And seeing how they are sitting at 88 points, not currently in a playoff position, they still aren't competing.
Yeah, so Columbus surprises me. I absolutely agree, and I think I've made that very clear on the show that I don't think they can win the Stanley Cup with John Tortorella. With that being said, the moves that they made, I certainly thought solidified them as a playoff team because I felt they were a playoff team coming into the season in the first place, so they have a lot of work to do. I agree that there are sort of tiers here, but I think it's a little more gray area for me than it is. It's more black and white for you. I think, really, I don't think Columbus can make a whole lot of moves here, but I think the other four could pretty much go wherever. Now, Carolina's not going to get to the top. That's just unreasonable. But they do have a game at hand, and should they win that game, they find themselves 2 points behind both the Penguins and the Islanders. So, do I think Carolina's going to creep in? Maybe, maybe not, but is it possible? It's absolutely possible. Incredibly close there. The Atlantic is not quite as close. Tampa Bay not only solidified themselves as a playoff team, as the division leader, but they have won the division, they have won the Eastern Conference, and they have won the President's Trophy for the league's best record. They have 122 points in 77 games played, which is absolutely absurd. Boston behind them has 101 points in 76 games, so even Boston is having a nicer season than everybody in the Metro, but they find themselves in second. Toronto in third with 96 points. Followed by that is Montreal at 90. Montreal, in my opinion, is basically locked into a wild card spot, as in they can't get higher than that. Certainly they are not locked into anything. Columbus is right behind them, but more of a four-team race there.
Yeah, absolutely. So Boston is actually tied for the second best points in the entire National Hockey League. It just is very unfortunate when you're 21 behind your leader. It's so incredible.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, Tampa Bay locked up everything with nine games. They could have literally forfeited their last nine games and would have had just the same advantage in the playoffs as if they had played them. It's incredible. But yeah, I agree with you 100% on this one. Boston is definitely the second. Toronto, they've even mentioned that they would probably consider resting some of their veterans in these coming games. Smart move, because really they are the three. I don't see them moving up or down. And then Montreal, that's a very interesting team. They currently sit at 90 points. They are one behind Carolina for the first wild card, two way ahead of Columbus for the second, but Columbus has a game in hand. Oh, and once you know it, they play each other tomorrow night too, so don't think that's a huge game. You are incredibly wrong. I looked at some of the remaining schedules for these teams left to see what kind of matchup these teams have. So Carolina has six games left remaining. Three of those are against current teams that are in a playoff position, whether it's East or Western Conference. Columbus also has three of six against current playoff teams. Montreal, on the other hand, all five of their remaining games are against teams that are currently vying for or in the playoffs. I include Columbus in that list because they are right there. But all the other four are against teams that are in there. So, I mean, if Montreal makes the playoffs, they will certainly deserve it, given how the end of their season is a lot more strong than a team like Carolina or Columbus is. So Montreal definitely has an equal opportunity to make a wild card push, but they certainly don't have any division chance.
Yeah, so very crowded playoff picture in the East. Tampa Bay and Boston, the only Eastern Conference teams that have clinched at this point. Obviously, within the next week, we'll see more teams clinch, but for now, it's just those two, and it's anybody's game for a lot of these positions. In the Western Conference, I would argue that we see a lot of the same. Starting in the Central Division, the Winnipeg Jets lead with 94 points. The Nashville Predators are in second with 92, and the St. Louis Blues are in third with 90. So that is quite the logjam there.
But weren't St. Louis in last place at some point in this season?
Yes, St. Louis was very close to last place. My bold prediction right before Christmas is that they would be in last place when we came back, and they decided that they wanted to be a playoff team instead. So they're vying for the division title as we speak.
Yeah, that's incredible that the Central has seen what we've had. I thought going into the season and throughout all the season, really up until the last month, that, okay, it's between Winnipeg and Nashville. The two of them have lived up to my expectations. They've swapped back and forth, both of which have clinched playoff spots already. Winnipeg does have the two-point advantage with a game in hand, so they seem to be putting themselves in a better position moving forward. But St. Louis came out of nowhere. They were dead to rights in the Western Conference. Then suddenly a man named Jordan Binnington came from the AHL and said, "Don't worry, I will carry the team on my back and shoulders." And boy, however, has he. He has put them in third place in the division, only 4 points behind. And with that game in hand, and that game in hand is against the Rangers too, I would arguably see that they have any opportunity to win the division as well as any of the other two. This is bad for Nashville. This is really bad for them. They have not been playing good hockey of recently. Winnipeg has been playing better because Nashville was in first for most of the season. Winnipeg has recently surged ahead of them. But Nashville goes from having a potential wild card matchup in the first round to now potentially having no home ice and having to play St. Louis. It's incredible. Dallas is also right there in the division, but more so in the wild card picture, rather. They have 84 points, so they are six behind St. Louis. A bit of a wider margin there. I really don't see them making a push for the third seed. But, you know, they're there. We do have to talk about them. But really, it's up for grabs between those three teams.
Yeah, I would agree. And there's some other teams there in the Central that we'll get to in a second here. But in the Pacific Division, the Calgary Flames, not exactly running away with it, but they're trying to separate themselves. They have 101 points, followed by the San Jose Sharks, who have 95. They have each played 76 games. The Vegas Golden Knights are in third, also with 76 games. They have 90 points. And behind them, farther behind them, is the Arizona Coyotes at 81. So the Coyotes will not get in. We pretty much have our three in the Pacific. Calgary and San Jose have both clinched. I imagine Vegas will be clinching almost any day now. But we essentially have our top two. I don't know that you can quite give it to Calgary yet, but they certainly are playing better hockey than the Sharks are right now.
See, this is actually interesting because I think Calgary is dead set as the one. The two is where I'm concerned because
I would agree with
San Jose and Vegas are playing two different brands of hockey right now. So Vegas, like you said, have not clinched yet. They'll clinch in the coming days. There is a 5-point gap between them and San Jose. In their last 10, San Jose is 4-5-1. That's good for 9 points. It's not very good, though. It's very bad for 9 points. When you have Vegas has come on strong lately, they've gone 7-2-1 over their last 10. That's 15 points. So in the same games, they have six more points on them. Whereas before, I thought it was a Calgary versus San Jose thing. I think now Calgary has been playing well enough and strong enough to solidify their spot as the one. But really, if Vegas keeps playing as well as they are, San Jose needs to look in their rearview mirror a lot more closely.
Yeah, and just to put more emphasis on that 2-3, regardless of where they finish, they would play each other. But again, home ice comes in big. The Sharks are 23-9-5 in their building, 20-15-4 away from it. Vegas is 23-10-5 at home, 19-18-1 on the road. So you're looking at two teams that certainly like to play in their own building. That battle for the second spot is going to be crucial there.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's even more crucial in the West is the wide open battle for the wild card.
Oh my goodness.
See, we had talked about it for weeks. It's been like the third or fourth time this has come up on the show. Would there finally be some sort of solution to the wild card problem in the West? Well, all these teams that are competing are saying no. So right now, as it stands, there are 8 points separating the first wild card from the fourth team out. I think Dallas pretty much has one of the two wild card spots solidified. Can we agree on that point?
I mean,
they currently sit at 84 points. They are followed by Colorado and Arizona at 81. They do have a game in hand on Arizona, tied to the same games played with Colorado. They're playing well enough, I think, to get them into a playoff spot, whether it's the one or the two.
I like Dallas enough to feel confident in their ability to hold on to that spot. I would not say, based on where they're at in the standings, that they are solidified by any means, because they have those two teams right behind them. But I like them enough to say that I'm comfortable with them making the playoffs.
Well, my whole who they're playing their last six games, they play 3 of 6 playoff teams, whereas all the other people competing play about 4, 5, or 6 all against them. So Dallas has the easiest schedule. That's why I feel confident in saying that. But right behind them, we have Arizona and Colorado, both at 81 points. Colorado has a game in hand, so they currently sit at the second wild card. Minnesota, they're a team that has been at third place most of the year in the division and now find themselves as the second team not in the playoffs. It's remarkable what Minnesota has managed to do themselves. They currently are at 79 points, 2 points out of the spot. Chicago and Edmonton, they're still there, but they're not really there. They currently sit at 76 points each, 5 points out. Once again, still have a game in hand over Minnesota and Arizona, but there's no way that Chicago and Edmonton can make it, right?
I mean, they're only 5 points out. They very much can make it. I don't think that they will. Not because of how far behind they are. They're very reasonable. They're in striking distance. It's more for me how many teams they have to jump to get there, and I think it's going to be tough to jump all of those teams and get in. You're looking at 3 or 4 for both of those teams. So for me, that's not so doable.
Yeah, but it's so weird because there's been so many times that, okay, Chicago, they've been dead to rights. Edmonton, they've, you know, basically had a whole fire sale. Their team got new GM, new coach, pretty much did everything except changed our locker room around. It's been ridiculous how much they've changed. Yet somehow they still find themselves competing. Now, I feel this is the same situation that we see in the NBA. Can these wildcard teams pose any sort of threat in the playoffs? We've seen crazier things happen. Nashville was the 16 overall 2 seasons ago when they made the Stanley Cup final. So it wouldn't be far-fetched, but I would say that these teams are definitely not the same caliber of team that Nashville was 2 years ago.
They can make a push. It all depends on how you're playing when you're going in, and it's going to be exciting to see over the next week how these teams play and who manages to punch their ticket.
Yeah, for sure. A week and a half left in the regular season. If you think we're not going to cover it next week, you are sadly mistaken. Right now, though, we are going to cover our break for the show, so please stay tuned, and we have some more Sports Takeover for you after this.
I don't want to fall, fall away. I don't want to fall, fall away. I'll keep the lights on in this place. Cause I don't want to fall, fall away. And I will lie, and I will take my precious time as the days melt away, as I stand in line, and I die as I wait on my crime, and I'll try to delay what you make of my life, but I don't want your way, I want mine, I'm dying and I'm trying, but believe me, I'm fine, but I'm lying, I'm so very far from fine, and I can feel. Every time selfish ambition is taking my vision. My crime is my sentence. Repentance is taking commission. It's taking its toll on my soul. I'm screaming submission. And I don't know if I am dying or living, because I will save face for namesake. Abuse grace. Take aim to obtain a new name in a newer place. But my name is lame. I can't walk and I ain't the same. I am my name. I gave a new destiny to the grave. And I can feel the pull begin. Feel my conscience wearing thin. And my skin, it will start to break up and fall apart.
I don't wanna fall away. I don't wanna fall away. I will keep the lights on in this place. Cause I don't wanna fall away.
Welcome back to Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris. We're going to move from the madness in professional sports to the madness in college sports. March Madness is through two rounds now. We're going to recap those rounds and look ahead to the Sweet 16. Chris, what were your thoughts on the round of 64?
Okay, my most important thought was that my bracket is not busted yet.
Mine is not either. We're all right, hanging so, in there.
Yeah, we are
barely, but we're hanging in there.
That is the most important thing to me. But for the round of 64, plenty of upsets, lots of excitement, lots of madness. So there were 12 upsets in the first round. There was 113, three of the four 12s won because why not? And 11, three of the four 10s won because why not? And all four of the 9s won. So if you picked 12s, good for you. If you picked any 7s or 8s, I'm sorry, but it did not work out in your favor. But no, there were certainly a lot of exciting games, a lot of exciting matchups. Some games went to the wire that really shouldn't have. One of them stands out to me is Tennessee. They only won by 7 as the 2 seed over number 15 Colgate. They were a team that did not give me much hope going into the round of 64, and they certainly lived up to my lack of expectations for them, giving Colgate a good game in a game that should not have been a good game. And yeah, these 12 seeds were really impressive to me. Murray State blew out Marquette. Liberty barely won over Mississippi. Oregon looked like they deserved the 5-seed over Wisconsin. They have played wonderful basketball. And Auburn only won by 1 in New Mexico State, but they really should have lost that game too. So beware the 12s for sure.
My goodness, I hardly have anything to say. You took everything right off my notes. One thing I will say is that number ones, although they all won, a couple of them had some issues. There were two of them that trailed to the halftime, Virginia versus Gardner-Webb.
Yeah, what the heck is Gardner-Webb?
UNC versus Iona. So they pulled it out, of course, as we expected them to, and then they won again. So they're fine. But there was a little bit of scare there for people like myself, who had one of them winning it all. Trailing at halftime is not what you want, but they got the job done. You talked about some close calls. I added a couple other ones here. The defending champion Villanova barely got past number 11 St. Mary's. It was 61-57, so the defending champs almost went down in the first round, but they pulled it out. Number 3 LSU against number 14 Yale. Those Ivy League schools.
I was pulling for Yale so hard.
I'm telling you what, 79-74, a close one there. That was really all I had for the round of 64. Upsets were fun to watch. There were some exciting games. Unless you have any other thoughts, we'll move on to the round of 32.
Yeah, just a few more on those things you mentioned. Virginia was giving people flashbacks to last season when they lost by 20 to the 16 seed. This year, they were down at half, and people are saying they can't possibly do it again. Well, they didn't do it again. They managed to pull it out. It is Gardner-Webb, after all. It isn't quite UMBC. Not that there's not much that can distinguish those two teams, but still. But yeah, that Yale and LSU game, that was one I was really excited for because I saw Yale play their conference final against Harvard. They look like a good team. Well, they forgot that the goal of basketball is to get the ball in the net because they were about 4-for-28 from three-point range, and one guy on their team in particular had probably the worst game of his career. He was, I think, about 1-for-15 from the field, who was one of their best guards. So it was definitely a game LSU could have lost. And in the round of 32, we saw another game that LSU very well could have lost. They went down to the wire against number 6 Maryland. They only won by 2, a 69-67 victory. So while LSU has found themselves in the Sweet 16, there has been nothing sweet about their two victories so far.
Yeah, LSU had a rough go of it in both rounds, and Tennessee did too. You talked about their struggles in the first round. Well, in the round of 32, they needed overtime to get past number 10 Iowa after leading by, I want to say, 25?
Yeah, it was. They were up by, I believe, 21 at halftime. They went up by 25 as either the end of the first or early in second, but they were dominant the first half, and in the second half, it looked like it was a recreational basketball team out there against a professional team. It was insane. Kudos to Iowa for making the comeback. Obviously, the better team won in the long run, but man, Tennessee has looked about as bad as they did in the SEC tournament in these two games so far.
Yeah, that was, I believe, tied for the largest comeback in tournament history. I personally wanted to see Iowa pull it off just
Absolutely.
Because how great of a story is that. But Tennessee did hang on. A couple other close calls. Number 2, Kentucky over number 7, Wofford, 62-56. I watched that game, and I don't think it was necessarily as close as that suggests. I didn't think Wofford looked all that impressive throughout most of the game, but they kept it close and gave the Wildcats a scare. Kentucky ultimately pulls it off. Number 1, Duke.
Oh, boy, Duke.
Half the country has this team winning it all in their brackets, and number 9, UCF, almost ended a lot of hopes and dreams. 77-76 was the final, and there was a questionable foul call, a missed rebound off a missed foul shot for UCF, and then they missed two shots as time expired. They had their chance. They could have come away with this win.
They deserved
to win.
They
faltered in the last 10 seconds. Duke lives to see another day, but my goodness, were a lot of people on the edge of their seats for that one.
Well, going to the last 2 minutes of that game, UCF actually had a 5-point lead at one point. Duke did not convert a field goal. UCF went the other way in transition, and instead of going for the easy layup, they went for an alley-oop. The alley-oop went out of bounds. Duke went down the court, scored a three, made a 2-point game. Obviously, they came back, but yeah, UCF, they had every opportunity. I mean, the better team won. Don't get me wrong. Duke is a better team than UCF.
For sure.
Were they the better team that day? No, they got a lot of luckiness. In the last 5 seconds, they had two field goal opportunities. There was a layup off the glass that bounced off the rim. A guy made a fantastic rebound, tried to tip the ball back in. Unfortunately for him, he must have spun the ball one rotation too many as it rolled right off the rim, but UCF had every opportunity. One other big thing in the final 30 seconds, their 7'6" center, Taco Fall, he fouled out, so he was not present to get those rebounds. He goes down as having the best field goal percentage in NCAA history to end a career. He had a 74% field goal percentage. Now when all you have to do is reach up like you're reaching the top shelf to grab a jar.
The man is 7'6".
It's not hard to get a good field goal percentage, but my goodness, it is still impressive nonetheless. But yeah, Duke definitely gave everybody a scare. Did I have them in my championship game? Yes. Would it have been exciting for them to lose? Absolutely. That's what March Madness is all about.
Unfortunately, we talked about the upsets in the round of 64. The round of 32 did not provide that at all. All of the ones, all of the twos, and all of the threes have moved on. The only higher seed that lost in the round of 32 was number 4, Kansas, and they lost to number 5, Auburn. So it's not even much of a difference there. Yeah, so we have, I believe, like I said, all the ones, twos, and threes, two of the fours, then we have a 5 and we have a 12. So a lot of what was supposed to happen now that two rounds are behind us, looking ahead to the Sweet 16, the East and the West are the two regions that have the 1 versus the 4 and the 2 versus the 3, pretty much as it was drawn up. In the South, number 12, Oregon, will attempt to be only the second number 12 seed ever to reach the Elite 8. And then, of course, in the Midwest, we have number 5, Auburn.
Yeah, it was the first time ever that all the ones, all the twos, and all the threes made the Sweet 16, which it's remarkable. I mean, these are clearly the better teams. That's why they're ranked 1, 2, and 3. But I find it very fascinating that they have reached this point. I think that Auburn should have been the 4 instead of Kansas being the 4. I think Auburn was a better team.
That would have been even less fun, though.
Yeah, honestly. But, I mean, Auburn won their conference. Kansas did not. They clearly were the better team, hence they won. And Oregon, like I said, they were mistakenly given the 12, I guess. Someone drew them and said, huh, Oregon, 12, huh? I guess so, because they have looked strong each game. The first game they won by a score of 72-54. The second game they decided to be just a little bit better and win 73-54. But they have been very strong in both these games. And considering that they play a little bit of a shaky Virginia team going into this one, I wouldn't say that it's so strong. You maybe have some doubts about that one?
I mean, I picked Virginia. I think Virginia can get the job done, but certainly Oregon is a team to watch. A couple other teams to watch. Number 2, Tennessee, and number 3, LSU, who we have discussed their shortcomings in the first two rounds despite winning both of their games. Tennessee had the close call twice. They're taking on a Purdue team that has had two pretty dominating wins in their
Purdue
first
looks really
two.
Good.
So that'll be interesting to see if Tennessee finds a way to pull that one out. For LSU, their combined wins come by a total of 7 points. They're taking on a Michigan State team whose smallest win through the first two rounds is 11 points.
And a Michigan State team that I still think should have been a number one seed, too. An LSU team that is not playing well. And yeah, for Purdue, one of their guards last game had 42 points. It's insane. I don't know that Tennessee's going to be able to guard them. Definitely some interesting matchups, though. Those games begin tomorrow. Any closing thoughts on this, Matt?
Yeah, one big matchup that I'm looking forward to, my favorite one, number two Michigan taking on number three Texas Tech. Both have won both of their games by 15 or more points. So these are two teams who have looked very dominant in the first two rounds going head-to-head. So while I'm not a fan of Tennessee and LSU and think it's going to be tough for them to win this weekend, these are two teams that I, right now, the way they're playing, would expect to see win over many. They have to take on each other. Watch out for whoever wins that one.
Yeah, definitely some interesting competition to be had. Sweet 16 games will be played out Thursday and Friday. Elite 8 games will be played out Saturday and Sunday. So next week, we got the Final Four coverage for you.
On to quick picks now to wrap up the end of the show. We have some big matchups with playoff implications, as we discussed earlier. So let's start in the National Hockey League. The Columbus Blue Jackets are going to be paying the Montreal Canadiens a visit. And I'm going to go with the Columbus Blue Jackets. Both of these teams are 5-4-1 in their last 10. I can't figure out how to feel about these teams, because while I feel like Columbus is the better team, they're on the outside looking in. I'm going to take them anyway. They're good on the road. We'll see if they can get it done in Montreal.
I am going to go with the Blue Jackets as well. They have the better team on paper, but there's really nothing that can separate these two teams very much. Montreal has one less win. The goal differential between the teams is one difference. Montreal has scored one more goal and given up two more goals, both 5-4-1 in their last 10. It is so hard to cut it. The only reason that I am picking Columbus in this one is just because the game will be played in Columbus. I think the home ice advantage will help them. I will go with the Jackets in that sense. Another exciting matchup to be had in the Western Conference, Minnesota will be playing Arizona. Big wildcard implications for sure. I will be going with the Coyotes in this one. I would love to see Arizona be the other wildcard team in there. I think Minnesota is done. I think they're just too old. Arizona has been playing a lot better recently. I'm going to go with the Coyotes.
I'm going to go with the Coyotes as well. The Minnesota Wild are 3-6-1 in their last 10. That's not the way you want to be playing hockey when you're a team that's trying to work your way into a wild card spot. For the Coyotes, they have been playing like a team that's trying to get into a wild card spot. Darcy Kemper, their goaltender, has been fantastic recently.
Yeah, your fantasy team would know that.
That's right. They sure would. I just am not a big fan of Minnesota, so I'm going to take Arizona. Finally, we have Flames at Sharks. Big matchup there for that division. I'm going to go with the Calgary Flames. They've won 6 of their last 8, while the Sharks are 0-5-1 in their last 6 games. To me, these are two teams that are playing very different hockey as we approach the postseason. I like the Flames.
Yeah, you hit all the important points there. I'm going to go with the Flames as well. They are clearly playing better right now. The Sharks are just hoping they can get by with that 2 seed for when Erik Karlsson comes back. Clearly, they need him on their team. Calgary looks very strong. I'm going to go with them. Moving into the NBA, we're going to start in the Eastern Conference. The only real potential flopping between the top 5 exists between the 4 and the 5, and that is between Indiana and Boston. Since Indiana's lost Victor Oladipo, they have not been the same team as many would have predicted. I'm going to go with the Celtics for that reason. Despite both teams not doing so well recently, I think the Celtics have a team that is built more for the future. They have a team that really can get the job done as we start to roll into the postseason. For that reason, I'm going to pick them in this game.
I'm going to go with the Celtics too, but I really didn't know who to pick in this. They're both 1-4 in their last 5. It's just not good. But the Pacers have not been good since mid-January. They have a losing record since that time. And you talked about Oladipo, and that's a big part of it. But when you're taking on a team like the Boston Celtics, you need to have something going your way. And over the last 2 months or so, things really haven't. So I'm going to go with the Celtics. Nuggets at Warriors in the battle for first place in the NBA's Western Conference.
Who would have thought that going into the season that would happen?
Absolutely nobody. And I know that you made a prediction earlier a couple shows ago that you didn't think the Warriors would get the top seed. I still think they will, so I'm going to take them in this game. Like I said, these two teams are tied for first. Denver, only 19-17 on the road. Not a fantastic record to take into Oracle Arena in Golden State. I'm going to take the Warriors.
So the one thing about my bold predictions is, while they may be wrong many, many times, I sure do stick to them. And so for that reason, I'm going to go with the Nuggets in this one. The only way that they can leapfrog the Warriors is if they defeat them in a head-to-head competition. It's an ancient Warrior matchup. Well, I'm going to go with the Nuggets in this one. Do they have the skill and position players that the Warriors have? Absolutely not. Do they have the team chemistry and composition that can get them the victory in this game? I think so, at least. So for that reason, I will go with the Nuggets. Two more basketball games, college variety. It's Sweet 16 matchups, two that both of us had predicted for the Sweet 16. That's why we chose to pick these two. I'm going to start with number one seed Gonzaga playing number four seed Florida State. I'm going to choose Florida State. Last season, these teams met in the exact same region in the exact same game, except Florida State was a 9 and Gonzaga was a 4. In that game, Florida State won, got the upset. I don't see any reason why they can't get it done against this year. For that reason, I'm going with the Seminoles.
I will go with Gonzaga. They've both played very well to this point in the tournament, but my issue is I don't think Florida State has been tested. They knocked out a 13 seed. They had a 12 seed in the second round. I think playing the top seed in this region is going to be a wake-up call for them, and I will take that top seed, Gonzaga. Our other matchup and our final matchup of quick picks is number 3, Houston, taking on number 2, Kentucky. I'm going to go with Houston. For me, Houston was a Final Four team before the games began. Kentucky is a team that I did not have in this position in my bracket. Overall, Kentucky has averaged 70.5 points through their first two games, which is below their season average. Houston has only allowed 57, which is also below their season average. They've got a very good defense. Kentucky's offense has not been as good. I'll take Houston.
I'm going to go with Kentucky in this one. They are the team I chose to win it all, so naturally I have to pick them in this game. It's very unfortunate because I thought Houston could have been a 2 seed. I would have picked them for the Final Four had they not played Kentucky, had they gotten, you know, matched against an LSU, gotten against a Tennessee. That would have been an easy pick for me. Unfortunately, though, they got matched against a Kentucky, and when you look at it, John Calipari knows how to get the job done. He knows how to get teams to the Final Four. There are tough steps along the way. Houston, while they did blow out Georgia State by about 30 and Iowa State about 15, they have not faced a team as strong as Kentucky. For that reason, I will go with the Wildcats. Lastly, to wrap up the show, we have some bold predictions. I will start in the NFL. It's also the same way we start the show. It's with Rob Gronkowski. While he is retired, I think that he is not done. I think he will still play another down in the National Football League, whether it's this season or next season, I will not say. But, you know, if Tom Brady calls him up and says, hey, Rob, we need you, come back. He said he's only going to catch passes from Tom Brady. I think if he gets the call from him, he'll come back.
Before I get to my bold prediction, it is worth noting in quick picks, Chris is up by 1. So while we're talking about the push for the title in these leagues, there is a push for this first season's quick picks title, and it is a very close one. So we'll keep an eye on that. Bold predictions also very close. I have 10 right. Chris has 9 right. Plenty are still pending. Lots can happen. I'll get to mine now for this week. In the National Hockey League, John Tortorella is a guy that we have both talked a lot about. Neither one of us like him. I especially don't like him. And I don't think he'll be the coach in Columbus next year. I'm looking at this team that goes all in at the deadline. They're not in a playoff position. If they do get in, I don't think they're going to make a lot of noise. It's just a team that is well below their expectations, and I think that there's one reason for that. I think Columbus is going to figure that out. Tortorella, enjoy your last couple months because you're going to be looking for a new job soon.
I wouldn't even say that's bold because I think that Tortorella should have been fired many times ago.
He should have, but they like him for some reason.
Yeah, it's insanity. You try the same thing, expecting different results, you don't get it. I like the bold prediction, though. Very nice. My second bold prediction will move into Major League Baseball. While we like the shorter-term ones, I sure do love the long-term ones.
Yes, you do.
162 games in a Major League Baseball season. Lots can happen. I think the batting title leader, whether it's American League or National League, it'll probably be American, but hey, it could still be National. I think the batting title leader will hit above 350. The last time that was done was in 2010, so it's been 9 seasons, 18 different batting title leaders. None of them have hit above 350 since that mark. I'm going to say it's going to change this year.
That would be exciting to see. I think that's a guy that anyone can get behind, so that would certainly be exciting. I have one from Major League Baseball as well, so I will match your long-term prediction. I'm going to go into the MVP race. We've talked a lot about big contracts, whether it be extension, whether it be the absurd amounts of money we've seen thrown around in free agency, but I think at least one of the MVPs is going to be someone who did not make this money, because the easy bets for MVP are the Harpers of the world, or the Machados of the world, the people who got these big contracts and who all the pressure is on. But I'm going to look to Houston and Carlos Correa, 24 years old, on a one-year, $5 million contract. He's on a great team in Houston. There's certainly the potential there for it to happen, and I'm looking for a guy under the radar more so, not making the huge amounts of money, to come through as an MVP, and Carlos Correa is going to be my guy.
I like that a lot. I'm a big Carlos Correa fan, definitely an underrated player, especially with the talent surrounding him in Houston. Good call. It'd be exciting not to see someone named Harper or Machado win it for sure. My last bold prediction will go into college basketball. Sweet 16 this weekend. Should be good teams playing good games. I think there will be a 20-point margin of victory in one of the 8 Sweet 16 games. You'd expect most of these games to be single digits or maybe even 11 points. I think we're going to see at least a 20-point margin in one of these games.
Interesting. Very possible. Trickier, though, with the close matchups. My last one is going to be in basketball, but I'm going to look at the NBA. We talked about home court, and this is where I'm coming back to it. I'm going to say at least 7 of the 8 home teams in the NBA's first round will win. And that's saying that without the playoffs being set, without seeing what the matchups are. But I'm looking at it this way. Only half of the current playoff teams have a winning record on the road, and 7 of them have single-digit home losses. So the home court advantage is incredible in the NBA. I think it's going to come in huge. I think we'll see at least 7 home teams win in the first round of the NBA playoffs.
That's bold, and that is certainly one that will be interesting, but we will definitely be able to cover it.
Time will tell how these all play out, but it's going to be an exciting couple of weeks here as we get to the postseason. Unfortunately for tonight, we are out of time. Thank you for tuning in, and be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll be back at the same time next week, everyone. Have a great night.